Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, and today we have a very special guest. Her name is Karen Olson, and when you hear her story, you will be inspired and amazed, and it might even make a difference in your own life. It's certainly reading her book, which is meant for more. Following your heart and finding your purpose has already made a huge difference for me. I hope you will get the book, and I hope you will read it and pass it on to everyone you know. And welcome, Karen. Hello.
How are you, Ari? Good to see you.
That's great. It's great to finally be here together. So anyway, I didn't really introduce you with all your background. I thought we could just kind of have you tell your story and have people get to know you that way. But
your childhood was a little bit traumatic with your mom, and that's where the trauma started, right?
Before that, you had a great relationship with her, and I had a good time, right?
Yeah, an ideal childhood. And then my mother passed away suddenly. And that caused a trauma.
Right. So now in the end, you later learned that she suffered from mental illness, right?
Well, she was depressed. She my sister was too. And so after the birth of my sister, she was quite depressed. And not herself. And they didn't get recognition of postpartum illness at that point. It wasn't accepted as it is today.
So nobody knew, and she was just kind of suffering on her own, would you think?
Yes, she saw a doctor, but the doctor didn't do much. You know, he gave her B12 shots, that's all, but it wasn't, she didn't see a psychiatrist or psychologist. It was different in those days, you know. Now it seems like everybody sees a therapist.
Yeah. So at the beginning, you didn't know what happened, but then later, did you find out that she did try to take her own life by jumping out the window?
Yes. I went to school. Well, Monday morning, I kissed my mom goodbye after we had breakfast together. And my grandmother was there. That's my mother's mother. And my dad took her to the train station to get the train into New York City where she lived and worked. And they left about 7:30. They left about 7:30. I left a little after that. And a woman who cleaned our house came at 8:00. And so in that little window of time, yes, she jumped out the window and on her head. She dove, probably. She was a great swimmer and diver. And that's what she did. And my dad was having an affair too. I think that obviously did not help. You know, it made her depressed. And, so instantly, my childhood was changed from, you know, sunny days and going to the beach with my mother and a bunch of kids to feeling very alone, even though I lived in what would be an expensive house in Darien. But I felt like a little bit homeless myself.
Mm.
So I think that triggered a lot of my compassion, because when you hurt so much, you don't want anyone else to hurt, or at least that's how I felt. And I think a number of people feel that way. And so that pushed me into wanting to make a difference. I knew what hurt was, and I didn't want others to suffer.
So growing up, I know your father, he didn't really get it, right? He wasn't emotional and didn't talk about it, right? But when you were with, was it Yaya? No.
Dada, my grandmother.
Yeah. When you were with her, could you be yourself more with her?
Oh, yes. After my mother died, my grandmother and I were close, and I would go into New York City every weekend to see her. So, you know, she was like a mother to me, which helped.
Yeah. Now you took, it seems like you took the train and you got all the way down to where she worked all by yourself, and you were involved, right?
I know people are amazed at that, but I can tell you, got the train in Darien and got off at Grand Central and then took the subway, the shuttle, and then another train to Macy's, walked up the door at 151, entered the door, and went to the book department where my grandmother worked. And yeah, that was it. And that was so much fun visiting with her at Macy's. You know, it was like my whole playground, looking at everything from clothes to furniture. It was really something. So that part was good. But still, you know, I felt sad. And right after my mother died, you know, I still, even with being close to my grandmother, it was hard. I was lonely, you know. And I would cry myself to sleep.
Now you're going back. You left at 7:45, and the woman came at 8. And your mom, John, where was your little sister?
My mother put her in the crib.
Wow.
Yeah, put her in the crib, which would have been unusual for her at that time, because she's not, you know, she had just gotten up, and then my mom put her back in the crib.
Did your sister, I know she's passed away, did she remember that day, or she was too little?
No, she was too little, but my grandmother told me that when she came, she was sitting on the steps steps to the upstairs with Carol, and she kept pointing upstairs and, you know, saying, you know, I don't know what she said, but making noises and pointing upstairs. So, but no, she doesn't recall it at all.
Mm. Wow. Okay. And then there was the one babysitter that would take care of your sister and feed her. But when you said, can I get in bed with you? She said, no.
Yeah.
That must have been terrible. Right.
Yeah. No, that was Charlotte. And she was very loving towards my sister. Charlotte had a baby when she was very young and had to give the baby up. And so she didn't have any kids of her own. So she became very close to Charlotte, which was good. And Carol was close to Charlotte. But Charlotte really didn't pay attention to me. She cooked meals, but we weren't close at all, you know. And my, like, for instance, when my mother was alive, I would sit on the sofa and lean against her and watch TV. So I wanted to go. Charlotte was watching television, and I said, can I lie on your bed and watch TV? You know, she had a chair, and one comfortable chair. And she said, no, I don't want you wallowing on my bed. And so she brought a straight back chair in the room, and she told me to sit there. But that was icy cold. So I left the room and went to the living room and just turned on TV. And so, yeah.
Mm. Wow. All right. So, and then you made it. And then you had another thing when your father got remarried and you wanted to be a nurse, right? And the stepmother said no.
Yeah. So you know, having my mother die in the way she did and so suddenly, I just wanted to help people. And that at that time, if you want to help people, you women would become a nurse. So, you know, I was a candy striper at Stanford Hospital. And I wanted to go to St. Luke's Hospital and Nursing School in New York City. And I was even a member of the Future Nurses Club, and it's just something I wanted to do passionately. But my stepmother said, you know, I was a nurse. You don't have what it takes to be a nurse. And she just told my father, no, you know, don't send her to nursing school. So I studied business administration for 2 years at college. And after that, and well, then I got married. And then after my divorce, I worked for Warner Lambert, which is a major pharmaceutical company. It's not Warner Lambert anymore. It's Pfizer. But I did well. It was a creative job. I was in charge of developing sweepstakes and coupon events so that the product would move off the shelf. And so I did quite well. I was promoted. It's a creative job. I liked the people and everything. But I still had this longing in my heart for something more.
Mm. So the whole time you had this longing, even though you were in a creative job, and then I know, you know, when you had seen homeless people with your grandmother, she would say, no, they're bums, stay away from them, stuff like that. Something different happened with Millie, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I, you know, going up and I was at grandmother's house on the weekend. There was a homeless man on the street where she lived. And I always felt so badly for him. I don't think I called him a homeless man. My grandmother called him a bum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he would walk on 112th Street and do this ritualistic behavior of putting his hands together, looking up at St. John the Divine, which was the cathedral at the end of my grandmother's block, and pray, and then come down and then lift up both of his bags. On either side of him, he had two bags with all his belongings. And so it just, you know, I think as a child, before people tell you how to feel, you feel you're open, you know, but then sometimes we become closed as we go through life. But anyhow, she said, no. I said, you know, it's buying gloves or something to eat. She said, no, he's a bum. And oftentimes they want to be like that, or they have thousands of dollars tucked in their bags. And so soon it was easy for me to walk by him, you know, and the compassion I had turned to fear. And so after a while, you know, I didn't see him. He was there, but I wasn't moving the same way. But then fast forward, after my divorce, I got a job with the Warner Lambert Company in New Jersey. And I would go into New York frequently for meetings. And of course, it was hard to walk a city block without seeing somebody who was obviously homeless. And, you know, lying on a subway grate, reaching into a trash can for that last bit of sandwich to eat. But I didn't talk to them. I just averted my eyes and went by. But this day, for some reason, I was about to pass a woman out in front of Grand Central Station who I'd seen before. She was probably in her late 70s. She was frail, had a cap over her head, and she had her belongings in two shopping bags on either side of her. And she always looked down like she was so depressed. And of course, I knew what depression was. We've been depressed myself. And I don't know, just on impulse that particular day, I ran across the street and I got her a sandwich, a ham and cheese sandwich and an orange juice. And when I came back, she said, thank you. God bless you. I haven't eaten since yesterday. And she reached up her hand to mine, and I held her hand in mine. And at that point, I thought, wow, I've crossed an invisible line. And I did, but I was really being true to myself. You know, society might say, don't go near those people and so on. But I was following my heart. And through that, I found my purpose. You know, Millie was the catalyst. From there, I told my two sons about Millie, Brad and Doug. They were then about 10 and 12. And my youngest son, Doug, said, let's go find more people like Millie in New York. So we made 25 sandwiches and we rollerbladed around Central Park, giving out sandwiches to who we thought those who would need it. But we depleted our stack of sandwiches very quickly. So the next time we went in, we made 50 sandwiches, and we learned that people in Port Authority bus terminal, you know, they're sitting on a bench, they're not waiting for the bus, they're simply homeless. We got to know John and Arthur and Abe and Lucille, many others by name. And so the sandwich became a vehicle to just say we cared. Go there and we'd sit down and talk with some of them. And I don't know, it just seemed like the right thing to do. Other people might say it's crazy to do that, and you know, with your two sons, but it was something that, you know, I was doing it from my heart, so it felt real, you know, it was real. And then the ones we got to know really well, I decided I wanted to invite them to Thanksgiving dinner. So I went in a couple of weeks before and gave them bus tickets, and I told them I'd pick them up at the bus stop. And the thing about that is, I'm not a very good cook. And yeah, and I've never cooked Thanksgiving dinner ever. I still have it. I would go over, you know, now I go over to my son and daughter's house, daughter-in-law. But this was one of the most joyous Thanksgiving, because you were just yourself. I mean, when you're sitting around the table with people who live in Port Authority, there's no time for airs or, you know, you have to be real. And, you know, that was a wonderful experience. And we did that for two Thanksgivings. And one summer they can join house for a picnic. And
so who cooked if you didn't cook?
Oh, who cooked? Right. Yeah, that's the worst thing. Well, I invited some of my neighbors, and Michael Harrison, you know, cooked the turkey, and Jane Fleming made some side dishes, and it all came together very, very nicely.
And did anyone say, oh, you're crazy, what are you doing?
Oh, yeah.
They did, okay.
They did, yeah. Well, yeah. Aren't you worried for your kids when you do this? And I don't know, I just didn't. I didn't feel worried at all. Maybe that is crazy, but I felt it was the right thing to do.
Right. But maybe, I mean, because that's what I was thinking, you know, like, I think when you're little, like you said, you do want to help because these are just people. Yeah. But then someone says, oh, no, don't help them, you know, stay away from them. And then you go, oh, like, these are not people. These are something other than people.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And you get afraid. And then, but when you somehow, when you looked Millie in the eye, you know, like you said, a line was crossed and all of a sudden she was a human. She was just another human, right?
Yeah.
And did you ever go back, or from then on they were just humans that you wanted to help? Like, did you ever get with you again?
In New York City, yeah, we went back about every other Sunday for about 2 years. We went to Port Authority with sandwiches, yeah, and sometimes clothing. Oh, at Christmas, the best Christmas was I would have Christmas in Summit, where I lived. My former husband would come, and we'd open presents in the morning. And then and that evening, I would go to my dad's house in Darien. But in between, felt like the real Christmas, because we bought Christmas presents for everyone, and gloves and mittens and scarves and wallets and wrapped them all. And, you know, it's just such joy, you know, for me. thank you, God bless you, and hugs and everything. And it's just, oh, you know, this is how it should be.
So this, so you were spending your own money on this, right? You just,
yes.
And you were happy to do it, right?
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah, wow. And how many years did that happen before you started having the big meetings and getting other people involved, do you think?
Well, about 2 years. Going into New York about for 2 years. And then after that, a friend of mine said, well, what about Union County? Why don't you look into your own county? So I did, and I volunteered at a soup kitchen at a shelter where I met homeless families. And, of course, you don't see homeless families on the street. But 35% of all those who are homeless are members of family. And so I met them and I heard their stories. And I thought, gee, you know, does the religious community know? I know the religious community knows about people who are homeless in New York in the streets. But do they know that families with children in our community are facing homelessness?
So once you figured out that it was families, did that change something in your mind?
Well, I mean, I thought this is, I can get more people involved. Not many people would go with their children into Port Authority, although we did have some individuals that did that with me. But I thought they'll be willing to help families with kids, you know? And so I planned a conference on family homelessness, an all-day conference, and 200 people came to my surprise on a Saturday, and they learned about homeless families. A woman who had been homeless spoke. And
how did you get the word out to get the 200 people?
I just plastered the place with flyers. I went to every religious congregation around in and around Summit, and had posters about you can make a difference. And then it had some facts about family homelessness. It was like the first step, the reason I had the conference was the first step had to be awareness before people would be willing to take action. Mm. And so I gave them sort of their Millie moment, I guess, by having this conference, because they heard from Wendy, who was someone who experienced homelessness, and he learned about the problems homeless people face and saw that, you know, they can be invisible, but yet they're in our community. And, you know, like when you go to a fast food place and you go through the drive-thru and the woman who hands you your hamburger or your order, you know, you don't know that she's homeless, but at the end of the day, she gets in her car and, you know, and picks up her children at daycare or her mother's house, and she sleeps in her car. So, you know, you see homeless people who are members of families every day, probably, but you just don't know. There's no telltale signs. They're not necessarily mentally ill or on the streets or in shabby clothes. And that's kind of the tragedy of families without homes, you know, 35%.
And is it all, would you say it's all, I don't know about all, but the reason they don't have homes is because of money. They had enough money, they would have a home, or is that not true?
Well, it's true. They would need more money, but the issue is the housing is so expensive. And for every four people, assistance for federal housing programs, only one actually gets it. So, and housing costs and rents are very expensive, and a lot of low income workers and service jobs just can't afford housing, or if they do, they're spending 50% or more of their income on housing, and along comes, you know, unforeseen medical bill or they lose their job, you know, they're just at a thin margin and they become homeless. So, yeah, the root cause is the lack of affordable housing.
Wow. All right. So when you, after you raised awareness, and this was just, this was in Union County?
Union County, uh-huh.
And then what happened after that?
Well, I didn't want it just to be a nice conference where people would learn about homelessness, and that would be the end of it. And I so said at the end, and, you know, I never considered myself a leader. And I didn't really speak at the conference. I had a rabbi, a minister, and a priest speak and facilitate. But I came up at the end of the conference and said, you know, if we work together and stay together, people like Wendy, you know, will have a home. And so we then met. I had meetings every other Tuesday at Christ Church and Summit to work on finding shelter. And it was very, very hard because of zoning issues, NIMBY issues. Nobody wants a shelter in their backyard. So we couldn't find this building. And that was very disturbing. So after a few months, I said, I realized that my one church, for instance, couldn't be a full-time shelter. I said to everybody, what if we work together? Maybe we can do together what we can't do alone. And so the program involves 12 congregations who take turns sheltering homeless families on a weekly rotational basis. So that meant, for instance, Central Presbyterian and Summit could only host about four times a year. And that was something people could do. And then we needed a day center. So the Y provided a day center for families. And we got a van to transport the families to and from the shelter and to and from the day center and the host congregation. And it was just amazing. I mean, families talked about, and they still talk about today, how much they feel at home, and but strangers that really care about them. You know, I think it was a healing that went on. And besides the fact that about 70% found housing in 9 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. And of course, it's cost effective too. But the thing is, we built community, and I realized that God didn't want me so much to find a building as he wanted me to build community. Because when you have people that care and a support system, you feel good, you heal. And, you know, many of the volunteers stayed in touch with families long after they left the program. One woman here in Summit, Anita Nielsen, she's still in touch with a woman, Stephanie, who was in the program many years ago. So it's just amazing. Other volunteers became godparents for the mom's children, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it really was building a community. So here I thought, oh, we can't find this building, what's going to happen? But sometimes, you know, one door is closed so another door can open.
And how did you pick those first, or any of the families? Like, how, it seems like if there were so many homeless, you didn't have that much room, you know. Yeah. How did you pick them?
Well, of course, we had the day center with their case manager, and agencies would refer families to us, and they would be screened and so on, and then they would become part of the program.
Oh, okay. So there was a whole screening process. Well, I mean, it seemed like, you know, the people, the volunteers just, you know, made the people feel so welcome. I mean, it seems, you know, it must have been the culture that you had created, that they were so well, I mean, open arms and bring them in. And
maybe exactly.
It's like magical, really.
It is. And then the volunteers would often bring their children, you know.
Yeah.
And that sort of real family environment. And one mom, I remember, she said to her daughter, we're going to go see the homeless. And so at church. And so they went, and the daughter immediately started playing with the other kids and so on. And then it was time to go. And she was in the car with her mom and said to her mom, when are we going to see the homeless? You know? Yeah. They didn't look homeless. She was just another child. That's sort of the beauty of it. Yeah. And then other counties nearby asked me to help them start what we called at that time an interfaith hospitality network. Now it's Gently Promised, but anyhow. So I worked with them, and they created their two programs. And then Philadelphia called me at Columbus, Ohio. And so I thought, well, okay, this is replicable. And so I developed a manual on how to develop the program and, you know, organized it a little more. And then it just grew. I was able to hire more staff, and I had people on staff go out and meet with congregations in a particular community. And then the one congregation would host the community meeting where I would usually speak. And so we quite easily developed this system for replicating the program. And we've helped more than 1 million men, women, and children over the past 32 years. So it was quite something. So, but then I decided in 2016 I would retire because I'd been doing it for quite a long time. It wasn't that I was tired at all or burned out. I wasn't. I was there to give someone else a chance to run the organization. And so I asked Klaus Ehlers, who had worked with me for 20 years, to become the new CEO. And so he picked up, and he's done a phenomenal job. And program continues to grow, and we're now more involved in homelessness prevention and intervention, diversion, transitional housing. And in other words, it's become very much full service.
Wow, that's amazing. All right, yeah. we're going to give you a little break right now and go to the commercial break, and then we'll come right back, okay?
Okay, very good.
All right.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation. So thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. An experiential social emotional platform that you can bring into schools, give your children, it sounds like, the kind of experience that they had at Family Promise,
that Karen's talking about, and just really bond with people, get connected. And if you want to bring that into your schools, if you have an SEL requirement or you just want to bring it in, go to KikoriApp.com and schedule a consultation. It really is an incredible, incredible company. And then, you know, I always talk about my books because I hope that if somebody else, just like, you know, Karen had her situation, my memoir is about when I was stuck and stuck in a marriage and I didn't know what to do. I just felt hopeless that there was nothing, but I got myself out of it and I wrote about what I did. It's called The Second Piece of French Toast. If marriage was my dream, why was I numbing myself? And so if you find yourself that way or you know someone who does, it's a great gift. It's a great story. And I really, you know, put myself out there. It's very real. It's very courageous. And in case it can help someone else, this book, this is my third book, Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. And this was about when I found myself on, you know, what I called the left side of life, where things didn't look so good. And I felt hopeless and helpless. And then there was another side that was a lot more fun, where there was possibility and excitement and passion. And so I decided to come up with techniques for spending less time on the left and more on the right. And I put them all in a book, Your Bullshit is Your Blessing, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. It helps me. And I have to remember them so that when I get stuck again, I can use them. And then this is what the commercial was about, Real Talk. Someone said to me, why didn't I speak up when I was married? Well, I didn't know I wasn't. So I developed a process. It's called the Getting Real Process. And if you're someone who has trouble speaking up and you don't even know what you need to say, you just know there's something there, just go to realtalkwithhillary.com and schedule time to talk. Because I totally understand. And sometimes we just need some help, just like Karen's organization. Sometimes you need help. And I know I never wanted to ask for it, but this is a way to do it privately and we can have a conversation. So now we're going to bring back Karen Olson, who has helped over a million people who were homeless. And that's just incredible. And before we keep going with your story, Karen, did you ever think that this would grow so big and that you would help so many people, or were you just taking it one day at a time? You know,
I was saying it one day at a time, but I didn't think it would grow so big. Although I have to say, after I developed about four additional programs, I thought this is replicable. One, there's a need everywhere. And two, people really are compassionate. They just need a way to get involved. And I also thought it was good for the religious community. You know, when I grew up, churches and I guess synagogues too were not involved in service work for, you know, and so it was very important for me to involve the religious community. So yes, it was hard for me to take in helping so many people. I still can't get my mind and heart around it. It's too big, you know, so.
You know, a lot throughout the book, you say, you know, I was struck by, and there's a lot of stories when you get the book, and again, it's called Meant for More by Karen Olson. She not only talks about how she did this and the story that we're talking about today, but so many stories about people who were not helpless, but they were in trouble. And mm-hmm. when they reached out somehow, you know, sometimes it's Family Promise, sometimes it's other organizations, but they really got this compassionate help that made them, you know, get confidence in themselves. Someone was mm-hmm. believing in them. I mean, there were people who took them shopping and bought them stuff, you know, I mean, just really so generous. I forget where I was going with this, but, you know, just that it helped the people who were getting help, but it also helped the people who were giving, right? And it was mm-hmm. kind of a two-way street. But, I mean, I was, you know, I just have to be honest since this is getting real. You know, I was feeling like I'm a little bit selfish that I never helped people and that I didn't think to, you know, I never took my kids to do that. And, you know, maybe we all have our own gifts, but I was, you know, you hear so much crap on the news and all sorts of negativity and fear-based stuff that it was so wonderful to read this and to hear about so many good, giving, generous people, you know, the volunteers and the other people. I mean, and I'm sure that's a reflection of you, because that's the culture that you created. You know, you lost that fear. You didn't seem to have distrust at all. You know, you just built it. It was kind of like you built it, and I will be up, right? Sorry, go ahead.
I am discerning, you know. I have a lot of faith and I just move forward, but I also am discerning.
So were there people that you didn't choose to work with, or were there some?
Well, we said no one with an active substance abuse problem. And so we had that screening.
Okay.
Now that's been relaxed, you know. But there's so many ways that people can make a difference. I mean, I ended up making a large difference, but you can start small. You know, you can pick up somebody's mail next door, you know, who's away and, you know, it's on the doorsteps or newspapers, or you can make a meal for someone who's not feeling well. There's just so many little ways you can help. But, you know, how I began grew larger. And yes, I didn't ever imagine it would be that big, but I'm touched by not only how families have been helped, but people like Pace, who is an engineer, and he worked for a big, big company. And he said to me, I only had time for church, my family, and work. And then he got involved with Family Promise as a volunteer. And then the coordinator of the program left. She couldn't do it anymore, so he picked that up. And he got very involved. He would have families back to his house, and he had a zip line in the backyard, and families would go on a zip line. And then he started coaching them on interview techniques and that sort of thing. And in the end, he just said, you know, through Family Promise, you know, I found my heart. Life became more expansive. I was feeling more. And people who volunteer are touched by this.
Wow.
So it's a caring community. And, you know, that's nourishing for me too, with the idea that I've helped too many people.
Mm. Yeah, go ahead.
But then, you know, when I decided it was time to retire in 2016, I traveled a bit. I went to India and Ireland. And then I had a small condo in Florida, and I went there on occasion, and I did something called cryotherapy. Do you know what cryotherapy is?
I think it's when you're very cold, based on what I read in your book.
Yeah. It's a chamber, and you go in this chamber, and the temperature is exceptionally cold. And but it's supposed to have mental and physical benefits for you. So I had done this about 30 times between Miami and Summit. And the attendant who was helping me was new. He said she'd only been there 4 weeks, but he assured me she was well-trained. Well, things didn't go so well. The temperature got so very cold.
Was that because she didn't know what she was doing?
Probably, yeah. It was so cold. In fact, when the EMT came, he said I was hypothermic. And
how many minutes were you in there?
I don't know. Maybe you're supposed to be in there 3 minutes, no more than 3 minutes. Maybe I was in there a minute. but it was way too cold.
Whoa.
So I kept saying, I'm cold. And she opened the door, but she opened it from behind the door. You're supposed to be in front of the door so to help person out. And so I fell like a popsicle and like hit my head on a raised ledge and couldn't feel anything below my neck. And so I called my two sons. I had presence of mind to do that. And they came right down. But I thought, oh, you know, why is this happening? You know, I was worried, but I began to get better. And today I'm in a wheelchair, but today I can walk with the help of a physical therapist and a special walker. So I'm making progress. But you know what? Again, there's a silver lining. I never even cried over that. I feel just the same. I feel healthy. I feel happy. It's because I don't define myself just as this body. My body might be broken, but my spirit isn't. And so things continued on. And I have wonderful aides and Jen Russom, who helped me write the book, is here almost every day. So I'm around people and good people, and I don't know, I'm happy.
So was it the cold that had you hurt, or was it the fall that hurt your neck? Did you break your neck?
Yeah, it was the fall, but it was the cold that's why if I wasn't so cold, I would have been able to step out and I would be okay. It was too cold, so get as rest of the day was in. Yeah, so it's a combination. Yeah, and so that happened in Florida, and then I stayed there for about a month at Jackson Memorial Hospital, and then I came back to New Jersey and stayed a month at the hospital here, Kessler Institute. And I go there as an outpatient for exercises and that sort of thing. And they're making many wonderful innovations now to help people so that they can walk. And I'm involved in some of those studies. So, you know, and also it now gave me time to finish my book. I had started it, but now I had time to finish my book, Meant for More. Following your heart and finding your purpose. And so, you know, there's a silver lining. I find a silver lining in a lot of things.
Wow. And I know you forgave that woman, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she called me and said, how are you? And I said, oh, this was maybe 3 weeks after the accident. I said, I'm doing better. I mean, it wouldn't even cross my mind not to forgive her, you know. Mm-hmm. And she said she had been depressed. So I said, well, I'm glad you called. You know, I'm doing better and everything. And she said, oh, you know, that made her feel better. She's not in that field anymore. She's not doing cryotherapy.
Yeah. I don't think she should.
No.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So life is, you know.
So that was, if that was 2000, so that's 8 years ago that happened, right?
No, 2019.
Oh, 2000. Oh, I thought it was 16. Oh, 2016, you retired.
I thought 2019.
And you were traveling. Okay.
In February, I had the accident.
Okay. So 5 years. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And then when did you start writing? You were already writing the book then?
I was already writing the book, but it was moving on slowly because, you know, I was doing other things. But after I felt better, then I could concentrate on the book and do my interviews with people and, you know, write it with Jen. And
how did you find the people to put whose stories you put in?
Well, we had 200 affiliates across the country.
Wow.
So I would look at their newsletters for leads or some of them were people I met when I would go out and speaking engagements, or I would call the executive director and say what I was looking forward. So it was really fun doing those interviews, and so many of the guests were so pleased to speak with me. Not that it was me particularly, but me representing Family Promise, because it's been so much for them. Yeah.
And I love the way you call them guests.
Yes. Well, yeah, that was important when we began the program. And, you know, as I said, it was called Interfaith Hospitality Network. So it was building a hospitality that homeless families are guests and the volunteers are hosts.
Mm. You know. And the guy from, I forget which company that you went, was it Kellogg's? And he was so impressed with your volunteer program?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, so you said, there was one place where you said, if volunteers were employees, then you have more than what? Do you remember?
No, two companies. I think it was Nabisco, and I don't know what the other one was, but we rank Ford Motor. We rank 46. If our volunteers, right, were employees, we'd be the 46th largest company.
Wow.
Which is really quite something. Yeah. And Joel Oros, when had a brand from Kellogg of 120,000, I think. He said, I love what you're doing to help homeless families, but what I think is amazing is you help so many volunteers get involved, because he was in charge of philanthropy and volunteerism. So he funded the volunteer part. You know, when you fund the volunteer part, you're also helping families, but that's what he was interested in.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing, right?
Yeah.
How many people volunteer? I mean, you know, they're not getting paid. They're doing it. Well, they're getting paid. They're getting paid in other ways than money.
Other ways.
Right. Yeah.
Go ahead. I just think people are really compassionate. They want to make a difference. And if you provide a way, they'll get involved. That's what we found.
Yeah. Yeah. So if people want to, we got a couple more minutes. If people want to get involved, how would they, is it familypromise.com? How would they find it? Or how would they?
Familypromise.org.
.org.
It'll be a list of where our affiliates are. So they can call that main number, or they can look on the website to see where there's a way you can type in your area to see if there's an affiliate near you. And then you can call that affiliate, because, yeah, they need help with all different kinds of volunteer activity.
Wow. Yeah. And it really, I mean, I would, and where can they find your book? On Amazon? Is that?
Yes. And can find the book on Amazon, on bookshop.com, Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
And they can also go to my website, Karen Olson, author.com.
Okay. Karen Olson, author.com. Okay. And that's OLSON.
Yes, that's right.
And I think, you know, if people are feeling lost or hopeless, or, you know, themselves, and they can go and volunteer, they might, you know, like it made a difference for you, or when people helped you and then you saw the difference. You know, when you know, the couple times you were sad and someone reached out to you, that made such a difference.
Yeah, that, I remember a woman, a volunteer in our program in South Carolina. She had lost her husband and she was suffering terribly. She became involved in Family Promise as a volunteer. When I went to speak there, she said to me, thank you so much for starting this program. It saved my life. Now, I know that guests will say that, you know, it saved my life, but here was a volunteer, because she was so depressed after her husband's death. She didn't feel like, you know, she had a purpose, and she was lonely and depressed, and she got involved in family promise, and she told me it saved her life, you know, helped her out of her depression.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's good for everyone, this work of life. It's good for everyone. Yes. Well, yeah. Thank you so much, Karen. I just, you know, when I met you the first time, I was like, I didn't really get it. And then I read the book and I was like, wow, this is just, you know, what you've done, what, you know, you never gave up. You just one person and you created this whole movement, you know, which is so much, you know, the world and the country needs us so much. And I hope the world gets out, because I think this message is so much more valuable than the fear that we see on TV. So it impacts hope and mankind, you know, and the goodness of mankind. So
we hear all the bad things on television, but there's another side of that that you don't see often, and that's the misery of people.
Yeah, and this is what, you know, for me, I always hoped it was there, but it was kind of like, I don't know. But this really made me see it is there. So thank you.
Thank you for having me on your program.
You're welcome. Thank you for who you are. Anything in closing?
No, I just thank you for having me and getting the word out. And I wish you continued success in what you're doing. I mean, what you're doing is you're helping so many people through your podcasts and, you know, choosing different people to come on the show. That's very creative and effective.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Karen. All right.
Thank you, Hillary.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony, and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.